resume our board meeting, talk about primary financial statements. I give the floor to Michelle or Rachel.
Yes. Michelle. Yes. Hey, well, I suggest I start with paper 21A, as paper 21 is intended as background information for the meeting. And it also includes the ASAP and CMAC GPF meeting notes. These were comments on our June proposals that we have considered in developing our proposals for this meeting. So agenda paper 21A outlines the staff proposals for an investing category and two comparable subtotals in the statement of financial performance. And it's a follow-up paper on the papers we presented on EBIT and the management performance measure in June. At this meeting, we'd like the board to focus again on determining a suitable approach for a straightforward non-financial, non-investing company, and we'll bring proposals to a future meeting about how the approach that we consider might be applied or adapted to more complex scenarios. So paper 21A is split into five main sections with questions for each one, so I'd suggest that we go through each section in turn and see how far we get through the paper. In the first section, which starts on paper 6, the staff have suggested initially prioritising our work on improving comparability in the statement of financial performance and including additional subtotals over our work on introducing a management performance measure subtotal. Now, if after developing our proposals for comparable subtotals, we find the outcomes too restrictive for a management performance measure subtotal, then we suggest we could consider other presentation options. We would develop proposals for a future meeting. For example, we could consider providing the management performance measure in a separate reconciliation or in the notes. So the first question for the board is in the question below paragraph 12. And for the statement of financial performance, the staff recommend prioritising greater comparability using comparable subtotals over retaining flexibility and including a management performance measure subtotal. Does the board agree?
I agree with the suggestion. I think it's more productive if we focus on the IBIT or similar subtotal. Many preparers already do. I think that we can deal with the management performance measure in the notes somewhere in reconciliation. There's a lot of questions around that, but I don't think it needs to be on the face of the income statement. So I do agree with the approach you're taking in question one.
Chuck?
It's the same as Anne. I agree with staff's recommendation. However, it does not rule out MPM, so we are going to discuss it, including the presentation like the page 29, the reconciliation on the face of the financial statement. One of the choices could be on the face of financial statement, we put another reconciliation.
Yeah.
Okay. Makes sense. I also agree with staff. I think it's absolutely key in this project for us to focus on comparability, because this was one of the key weaknesses in using financial statements around the globe. Just one question for clarification. In the pod discussion paper, we have specific questions about the EBIT. And do staff have any initial feedback? I know it's still open for comment. That would reinforce our direction here in terms of EBIT?
We've actually had relatively little feedback on those proposals on the EBIT. I think people are broadly supportive of the idea of an EBIT subtotal and the discussion in the pod, but we've had limited feedback.
Tom? Yeah, I think this is a really, really critical decision. And I just want to make sure I understand what it means. So when you say prioritizing this, how far back does the management thing get pushed?
It's just to allow us to focus on this. I think at some stage we need to bring the package back together. But it's just to allow us on to think of the difficulty and the conflict between introducing more comparability and also retaining full flexibility. I think because of the difficulty of bringing both of those in, I think it's worth focusing on one of those first, but ultimately we need to bring the package back, I think.
But then an answer like how far back does it get pushed?
maybe the next meeting. I don't.
Yeah, but, all right, I guess I see these as complementary things, and I'm not sure they're independent. Separating them makes sense if they're independent. If they are in some sense related, then you go all the way through and then you discover all the interdependencies later. And the question is it easier to deal with them by learning them as you go, or do you want to wait and try and back out and repair? So it kind of depends what you mean by prioritizing. And they're answering different problems. When I kind of think about reporting financial performance, I've got at least four dimensions, and I've got two major ones. The first one is operating financing, which is what the EBIT, or I actually quite prefer your description of it as profit before financing and income tax. That's a much better description. that's what that one, it's on the operating financing dimension. And I think equally important, however, is what I would call the persistence dimension. How do you pull out the elements from the financial statements, either cash flow or statement of financial performance, and help investors decide what are the persistent elements going forward? What we're going to focus on will say nothing about that. Even though I think they're equal, I think actually out in practice and in terms of the press and stuff, persistence is the more dominant one right now. The other two are precision and intangibles, and I'll leave them. I'll just mention them. And I think the investing stuff is basically an elaboration or a possibly quite useful bolt-on to the profit before financing and income tax. So that still doesn't get us to the persistence issue. And I think it's a major concern. I'll just cite some things. There's a significant decline in the association between IFRS or FASB gap income and prices or returns, no question. I think in the Lev Gu book, it's exaggerated somewhat, but that's getting a lot of play and a lot of people are quoting it. The
sorry, Tom,
there's the Lev Gu, the end of accounting book.
Yeah.
It's getting quoted a lot, and other people, there are other books, a lot of people are raising this decline. And it's certainly strongest in newer knowledge-based industries. This relationship is much weaker. One of my things when I look back is these criticisms tend not to make an effort to distinguish. Sorry, I'll go back one step. We have put in, I think correctly, in capturing representational faithfulness, more one-time amounts than there used to be. In part, we put some of these in OCI in an effort to help people with this task. But I think the task of helping people discern one-time relevant items from more persistent items is a really important thing for us to be thinking about. So I think that's kind of an important thing. And again, all this evidence. So there's some evidence. There's these books. There's the decline. And the other big thing is the rise of pro forma or non-GAAP earnings measures. Highly increased proportion of entities using them. I mostly had to look at U.S. Data. I suspect some of the things I state which relate to U.S. data may be less pronounced, but are probably certainly there in IFRS reporting entities. So I think up till about 2000, the non-GAAP measures tended to be perceived as opportunistic and not particularly reliable. In the US, when the SEC put in Regulation G in 2003 and imposed discipline and said they were going to start looking at these things, it seems they changed quite radically. Certainly also the degree, at least the evidence in terms of which they're correlated with prices and market returns jumped markedly. So this reconciliation was really important. And GAAP in that reconciliation is kind of an absolutely necessary foundation. But I think we'd like to be more than a foundation, because if I look at the way the world's going, if we simply are the foundation, I don't think we're doing all we could be doing. So we can sort of provide a nice solid GAAP number and people will do the pro form or the non-GAAP. I think, so I'm really, when, that's why I sort of asked this question. I think this dimension is absolutely essential for us to be looking at, is how do we deal with telling people about the persistence of various cash flows and earnings items? And I think it's something we have to talk about. And I actually think it can be done in parallel, because I don't see these as competing. I don't think there are actually that many items that would be below the financing line that are the ones that the people who are worried about this stuff tend to worry about. When I've gone and looked at a series of these non-GAAP measures, they tend to fall into two types of adjustments. They tend to pull out one-time, I'm going to say, amounts. In particular, this is U.S. data, and the number of restructurings has jumped really markedly, and I don't know how much this applies to the rest of the world. But so lots and lots of those, plus a whole raft of other one-time items. And the other things they tend to take out is the stock-based compensation expense. They take out intangible amortizations, and in some cases, they take out R&D, which goes to that intangible issue. And they're actually pretty consistent. And sir, and again, if you go and look, the number of adjustments for the ones that have to answer the SEC where they do the reconciliation have dropped markedly. So imposing some discipline seems to affect the way people do this. So kind of having looked at all that, I'm very nervous if we take the persistence dimension off the table for any extended period of time. And so I'm happy with the prioritization, because I think it's a logical way to go, but I really would like us to think hard about what we can do on the persistence dimension, because I think we're making a critical juncture about a critical choice about whether we're a foundation to a whole pile of non-GAAP measures, or whether we'll provide direct information about persistence.
I agree with Tom that, well, first of all, I agree with the staff recommendation, but Tom does so as well, that we give priority to trying to sort of define EBIT. I don't think we will be able to define an NPM, but I also believe that the persistence dimension is incredibly important, and that we, and I don't think that just finding a way to present them is enough. I really think we need to impose more discipline around the presentation of unusual, extraordinary, one-off items. So I strongly support what Tom said. If we go to prioritize this in terms of trying to define subtotals, does not mean that we should deprioritize the NPM, or at least trying to formulate guidance around management performance measures.
I don't disagree with what Tom said, but I can't. Where have we got to in terms of putting any structures around how this management metric works in terms of whether it actually will bring out information about persistence?
I think we didn't take any decisions on the measure. But what we were discussing was whether we would allow them to isolate infrequent as well as infrequent.
Allow.
I think infrequent we were thinking on the persistency lines.
Nick.
First of all, I'd like to thank the staff for the papers and the previous papers. It's helped me navigate to where the board have got to today very easily. Very sympathetic to what Tom said. Management performance measures are very important, but I think to make headway, we do need to prioritise on EBIT. And if we don't, we'll end up having a very long and protracted discussion. I think we can make headway on EBIT and then come back quite soon to management performance measures. And the last point I'd like to make throughout the paper, not so much in the question, sometimes we refer to a comparable EBIT number. We're working towards a more comparable EBIT number. It's certainly still not a comparable EBIT number in many respects. We just need to be careful around that.
Well, I support the staff recommendation. Having that as a priority and having that as a primary focus. But I am still interested in facilitating as much as possible the presentation of measures within the statement of performance. I would not preclude anything at this stage. I'd like to facilitate that.
Mary?
answering this question, but maybe peeking ahead a bit to the others, I think I'm supportive of the staff recommendation because I concluded that, number one, we have to identify an anchor for comparable analysis and, you know, take Nick's caution that it's not necessarily an absolutely comparable EBIT, but I think we have to have a single anchor. I'd say the second thing that I then focus on is more guidance around aggregation and disaggregation, which is an indirect sneaking up on some of the items that Hans and Tom were talking about. And then only third do I come to the minimum line items, you know, looking further. I really prioritize that single anchor, you know, point, and then think about aggregation, disaggregation. Now, in answering question one in particular in the staff recommendation, something you've raised and we don't give that much time to is covered in paragraph 11A3, which is the columnar approach. I came into this project saying, I think the columnar approach is something that I have maybe more instinctively than anything else regarded as abusive or problematic, etc. But as I think about the constraints we face in trying to get an anchor for comparability, but also not have that anchor limit the ability of management to develop their own measures, I come back to saying, is the columnar approach really something that would help us clear that logjam? Because with a columnar approach, management could isolate items that are both above and below the EBIT line in terms of developing their management performance measure. Now, I think I support the staff recommendation. I also support developing more fully an assessment of how the columnar approach may help bridge these two items and being very proactive in our outreach about it. I think you may hit resistance that's inherited experience with it, in either people very kind of reflexively supportive or people quite reflexively anti, and I think we have to kind of get them to look at it and almost clear their minds and give some feedback on that. And I bring it up now because I think this is where it gets mentioned in passing, but to me, yes, I support prioritizing an anchor of comparability, and so I support the staff recommendation. But in terms of how that might override or trump or constrain our ability to encourage, but I think not require management to do a management performance measure, I think the columnar approach might, you know, it's something I feel we haven't tested enough.
I also support the staff recommendation. I think EBIT should be, subtotal should be due first. And with regard to the MPM, management performance measure, subtotal, from my point of view, I think I prefer, as said that before, I believe that it's better to bring MPM in notes or some reconciliation statement in the notes, not on the face. If on the face, it will bring more and more subtotals on the face. And currently, the practice is that different companies has been using different line terms. Once, of course, we have having more subtotal, maybe enhance or provide more discipline on prepares to provide line terms, line items. But once MPM move onto the face, it will result in the people to prepare. Try to identify which item should be, you know, should be on which part of the subtotal, which part of the subtotal. It will become much more complexity of our project. Yes, so I think at this moment I support the staff recommendation to EBIT first.
Well, it's obviously a good recommendation because everybody's talking about the next step.
Thank you. I support the staff recommendation also for all the reasons expressed, but one or two others. First of all, I think EBIT is going to be daunting and challenging enough to get something that works across industries and from simple to complex companies. So I think that's where the effort should be, because I think comparability is more important or between companies than perhaps the other items. I am not very optimistic we're going to get a satisfactory answer on management performance reporting on the face of the statement of performance. So, you know, up till now, our discussions have been, you know, what line items are above or below the line or excluded. And if it was that simple, maybe you'd get there. But, you know, we're not even talking about constant currency, which is the most extremely common management performance measure. But there's others. You could have cases where you don't quite qualify for discontinued operations accounting yet, but you've already made the decision to get rid of something, and it's going to be a little time. So how are you going to deconsolidate that on the face of the P&L and so on and so on? So I think there's a very long list of other things other than just grouping subtotals. With respect to, you know, paragraph 11, I actually support whether a separate reconciliation or in the notes, I support that. Actually, I don't support the columnar view. To my way of thinking, the primary financial statements are supposed to be structured summaries, upper word summary. If we go through all the recommendations we have discussed and will discuss, it's not looking like much of a summary anymore. And to clutter it up with two or three more columns of the management view, and again, I just think it's getting a very busy schedule, and its first thing is a structured summary, and that's what notes are for, to provide details.
I think I support. I just want to confirm after the discussion that you had with Tom that I know what I'm supporting. So my understanding of the prioritization was essentially we're going to spend a couple of months or maybe 2 months working through what EBIT is, and then we will move on to the management share. It's not a case of us trying to do both of them in the same paper like we were a month ago.
Yeah.
It's not a case of stretching this project out and putting it far in the future. So that then I do support. And then I think probably the other point just to make is, and this is maybe more of a marker for later, is I'm very, Nick used the word, very sympathetic with the way Tom spoke about persistence, but that's not the way I understood the management performance measure. I think that's now a third measure we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And that would just be my view now for future thinking.
And the columns have been brought up, and we've had a couple of views on the columns, and there's some fantastic examples of the columns being used really well, and that's commonly in the notes in this reconciliation note, and Tom has referred to how useful people finding good, clear reconciliation notes. If we start looking at columns and thinking, I think we also have to think about the segment note. Now, I know in a previous meeting, it's touching the segment standard has been scoped out. However, over in the segment note, a lot of these MPMs appear in columns or by segment. So I think we have to be aware of that, that there's a disclosure activity in the segment note that is relevant to what we would be doing over in on the face or in any reconciliation note.
All right.
Yeah. Oh, just a small note. Studies of the, again, American data, of the pro forma measures suggest about 50% picking up one-time items and 50% picking up amortizations and stock, so it's an expense that they don't really like. So it's about 50-50 in the sense of, does the MPM get you there? The MPM as practiced right now is about half and half. And it's something we'd have to think about if we go down that route.
Sue? I agree with the staff recommendation. The only reason I asked the question about persistence was I wasn't sure what the plan was in terms of how much specificity we were going to be putting around the management number, given that we want management to be able to show their views. So even if we all thought that it was a good idea to have the sort of persistency focus, I'm not sure if our plan will be to focus on that specifically and sort of have that almost as a requirement or even an expectation, but I guess all will be revealed when we circle back to that metric again.
Yeah. On the persistence point, one, the one idea I recall, the what I recall from our previous discussion about persistence was kind of an if-then formulation of, if management is making adjustments to get to a management performance measure that identify items as non-recurring or infrequently recurring, which is kind of the persistence notion, that we were going to consider whether to shift a disclosure requirement to present a history of adjustments. And so I recall that as kind of the persistence notion. I had understood that very often what management represents that it's trying to achieve with some of the adjustments might be couched in persistency terms. So I was thinking of it as just a general driver for why management might want to do a management performance measure, rather than something that was going to become an anchor of guidance that we provided around it. And I'm not arguing for one or the other, but maybe for the staff just to think about clarifying, you know, what approach we're doing. And I think I'll tag on an observation that when we started our work on the conceptual framework and around OCI, persistence certainly was one of the first things that we looked at, whether persistency and isolating persistency was one of the principles that we could use to distinguish when something is recognized in P&L versus when it's recognized in OCI. And I think our early research on persistency in that context led us to conclude that it's too much in the eye of the beholder in terms of frequency and a variation across company to be a use, you know, to be operationalized. It's very useful as a concept, but it was very difficult to operationalize. And so I kind of say, well, look back to see what you can recycle from our work there, if that gives us any indication, rather than us going through the same thing in a different setting.
All right.
All in agreement with the proviso that we also bring back the management.
Yeah, I don't think we need to vote.
So the second section of the paper considers whether we should introduce an investing category in the statement of financial performance. An investing category was a suggestion made by some board members at the last, at the June meeting. The staff is suggesting we could define investing income and expenses based on the definition that was discussed and included in 2010 staff draft in our previous financial statement presentation project. We also acknowledge it might be helpful for the definition to be supported by guidance, say in the form of illustrative examples, to help ensure that that definition is interpreted more consistently by entities. Question 2A for the board is below paragraph 30. The staff are recommending that we should introduce an investing category into the statement of financial performance and define investing income and expenses as income and expenses from assets and liabilities that yield a return for the entity and do not result in significant synergies for the entity in combination with other resources of the entity. Does the board have any comments?
Nick?
It's just really some clarification here. I know in previous discussions at the board, it was highlighted that associates can be of a different nature. Some are much more integral to a business's operation, some are more peripheral. Under the proposal, is it clear that all associates would fall into this category, or would some fall above this?
I think we would need to bring that discussion back.
Okay, because if they fell above this and not in this category, I'd be extremely uncomfortable with it, because we need a line that can be related back to revenue. Everyone will take an EBIT line to do a margin calculation. Clearly, we don't have any revenue contribution from associate in our top line, and it would undermine the measure very quickly if we were to split associates in that fashion.
I think you could argue that with the integral, non-integral would be similar to thinking about the synergies, not having synergies, I'm not sure.
Just to be clear, I'd have all associates, if we're going to have this category, in this category and not anywhere else.
If that's the case, do we need this category then?
What's the question?
If we do what Nick proposes, we still need this category? Or?
For things like masterful security.
Well, and Nick, you were saying you'd want, if we had this category, you would want all associates to be in this category rather than to be...
Yeah, not above it, certainly.
Yeah. Without any surprise, I support the staff recommendation.
That's not surprising. Chen Chao.
My point is that I'm thinking that if introduce investing category, maybe some problems. For example, in China, there are many joint ventures there. For foreigners, foreign companies, they go to open factory or other areas. Because of some legal issues, they cannot hold companies, that they have to open joint venture there. And actually, those business is integrated to their main business for those investors. If we try to separate their main business and the investor category, it may not faithfully represent their main business, their main operation profit. So I'm thinking that we should, you know, try to look at different situations. Yeah, whether if we try to bring new category, maybe we resolve one problem, but maybe new issue will come out. Yeah. So because those business from those investors, they believe that those business is same, such as car makers, something like that. They account to the how many selling of cars, how many profit they make, they integrate each other. If they bring whole number together, they will not separate them. So this is first one. Second one is that when we bring in new investing category, actually the staff has discussed that, how to define them. Actually it's very difficult because currently we have a cash flow statement there. There is a definition, there is some definition there. And different countries may have different defined definition there. So I hope that we need this kind of column. For example, we can just introduce investment income or something like that, and let users or investors just to adjust this kind of number to do what they need. Depends on different companies, different business model they have adopted.
Martin?
I agree with staff recommendation, but I, with the others than Nick, I think we have to distinguish between at equity instruments, because mind there are many, I think it's not the only purpose that we have this EPI to calculate a margin. Is, I think for me it is more okay to show what is the operating result of a company and makes her comparable to others. And some have a lot of operating stuff in at equity accounted companies. For example, research and development activities are shared with us as joint ventures, and why we should exclude it from operating, I'm not so sure. Therefore, I think we really need the discussion, okay, do we have one at equity line, maybe one then in the investment and others in the operating, but I think we should have really this discussion, because otherwise not resulting from that all at equity going to the investment line, because I would be not happy with that.
Thank you. I'd rather prefer to what the Nick suggested. We should provide a single line where all the equity accounting should go. So then providing some investment word is, I would agree. But one question is, if we say investing is the category without significant synergy, then lots of people would disagree that, because as long as you make an investment to associate, they think they have a synergy. So they think it's not the investment category, it should be above the investment category. So I would suggest to change the definition rather than significant synergy, that we could say investment activity is the activity which is not under control of the company. So because I think this is just a presentation. So if we get into the discussion whether it's integral or not, then it never ends. It's not a matter of presentation, it's a matter of IS 28. So therefore, in order to avoid such kind of discussion, I think it should be kind of just simply presentation only. So as long as you use the IS-28, everything goes to this line item. And then in order to consistent, then we could use the idea of control rather than synergy. So otherwise, you know, we will lose the point of introducing investment category.
Can I just say, for the purposes of this meeting, we're not actually asking the board to make any decisions about whether associates and joint ventures would actually sit within this investing category. All we're saying, all we're asking for at the moment is the idea of introducing the investing category, and we will at a future meeting bring a paper that will say, okay, do you want the associates always to be in the investing category, or do you sometimes want them elsewhere? So if perhaps we could just focus on the question as to whether you think it would be a good idea to introduce the investing category, and then we can talk about the associates.
But the board is, just, as usual, just making you aware of all the problems that they're having.
Well, we appreciate that. Thank you.
And then we are very good at that. And you have to solve it.
It might be helpful as everybody's automatically thinking the synergy word is to do with sort of associates, control, subsidiaries, etc., etc., which is, I don't think, what you were thinking when you were writing it. I think you were thinking more about, I don't know, machines used in factories or something. I don't know. What were you thinking about when you were talking synergies here?
Really, I was just looking at something that wasn't involved in the operations of a kind of income and expenses.
Like?
I guess it would be something like fair value changes in marketable securities. I realise that some companies, certainly the straightforward ones we're talking about, may not have very much in there or anything in there, which makes it more difficult to think about.
But I can't imagine a financial instrument would ever be something that would give rise to a question of synergies.
I mean, maybe synergies is something we need to think about, the wording. I used it as a starting point because it was in the staff draft.
Okay. I thought you were thinking more of, I've got a machine that produces widgets, therefore it feels like more of an operating thing than an investing thing. Mm. Yeah, I think that's why you're getting lots of comments about
exactly
associates.
Exactly this line, that's it.
So let me finish. One more.
Oh. Dr. Gilbert.
Yes, I think it's a good idea to introduce the word investment. However, I'm a little bit skeptical to introduce the category of investment. So if we introduce the investment category in the profit or loss statement, then it looks like we are going to divide profit or loss statement into three blocks, which is not really good. And my question, maybe this is the question five, we can discuss later. However, you are proposing to introduce two subtotals. I agree with the first subtotal, the profit before investment. However, if that is the case, do we really need a second subtotal? Because if you have a second subtotal, still distinction between other investment and the other interest income or other interest-related income is quite difficult to distinguish. So therefore, EBIT line cannot be comparable anyway. But instead, if we introduce the investment category and if we put the single line for the associates, then the first subtotal could be very comparable. So then, if we our aim is just to provide the anchor point of comparable, then I don't think it's really necessary to have a second subtotal.
Thanks. I agree with staff idea of developing this, but I just would like to concentrate on what you state in paragraph 25. This paragraph 25, my sense is that together with this or direction to introduce these categories, you are somewhat making reference to our previous 2010 proposal. And in paragraph 25, I was expecting the next paragraph to be somewhat a complement to 25, because 25, there are lots of messages here for me. So there is one that's the informal feedback was generally positive, so that's very good for this project. So it seems that we are in the right direction. And then you come with, however, some felt the application would not enhance comparability, and then I paused here because we are seeking to enhance comparability. But I accept that we are back to this project after the staff draft. So just maybe clarification to this point, what's your initial assessment on comparability? I think it would enhance if we have something different from what we proposed back in 2010. And also, you mentioned that about the examples weren't clear, and then mentioned the exactly associated and joint venture mentioned by Qingtao. So what's your idea, considering what you mentioned here, 25 and 24, 23?
Well, I think the idea was that the definition would be a starting point, and we may need guidance to support it to get comparability. My understanding, the staff draft, that the definition was intended to be as applied that investments in associates could be classified as part of operating if they didn't meet the definition of investing. So it did allow the judgment for the associates and whether or not we want to have a single location for associates or not. And if we did, then we would need to bring in additional guidance to bring in greater comparability. I think the confusion with the definition was things like whether, because one of the illustrative examples provided was the associates, people may have misunderstood that meant that associates had to always be classified as investing, but the intention of the staff draft was to allow the judgment of applying the definition for the associate to be in operating or investing. Yeah, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And just to mention that in those days we had a definition for operating, we had a definition for investing. So the classification of items was really definition-driven. So the staff draft, as Michel mentions here in paragraph 24, mentioned some examples of items that would typically be classified there. But it was really based on the entities, on the preparer's judgment, based on the definitions that had been developed at the time.
Just like I'm in favor, I think just we have to be careful about where we are. If I understand Nick correctly, he'd like all of the associate investment joint ventures in one place.
In investing, as it's been described, yeah, and certainly not above it.
Yeah, and I think I think we need to explore this fundamentally. So that's why I'm a bit concerned, just that we're not really voting on define. You know, item B probably needs massaging. The sentence up above in paragraph 30 says, I know where you're coming from. This definition focuses on identifying returns on investments that are separate from an entity's operations. So you're very much in trying to sort out the investing investments from the operations. And separately, we've got this cash and marketable securities as possibly a deduction from the debt. And then we've got this other one where we try and, you know, use the significant synergies to sort out what's operating and what isn't. And if you stop and think of these boxes, you know, there's a sub, in other words, Nick's subset includes the non-operating. The operating excludes some of the others, so I don't know that we're at the point to choose which box we want to be in. I think we need to do a bit more on that. But I'm sympathetic to the basic idea that we have to sort that out, but I just don't want to sort of approve something that we haven't fully discussed and solved. And I think that's this whole question about, I like doing, right from the start, if I can distinguish operating from financing and ongoing items from non-ongoing items, I'd like to do it. If I throw all these, there may be investments that the company's ready to liquidate tomorrow, and they're not ongoing operating things. So I'm concerned about throwing them in with the ones that they're going to keep forever. On the other hand, I'm sympathetic to the concerns Nick raised about margin, and initially, you recall, we actually shoved it down for tax reasons. Because the problem with this stuff is we bring it in as a single line item. And I just, could we just kind of park a decision until we've really studied that part of it, or just put a little asterisk that we may want to review?
I wonder if maybe it would be more productive if we focus on the objective that we wanted the reason for having the investing category. Mm-hmm. And then probably we could then develop a definition or what we think is going there for a future meeting. We had maybe some guidance from the board on what the board felt was the objective in having the investing category. I think it came out of the last meeting as a way of avoiding having the interest on assets outside capital structure below EBIT. It was a way of avoiding the problem of splitting out that interest from the fair value changes. Maybe if we had a clearer direction on what the board felt the objective of the investing category was, it might be helping to develop the definition further.
Well, even if paragraph 28 clearly indicates that we shouldn't make any decision on the issue, it also in a way introduces the subject. And when you have the definition of the investing category described the way it is, you inevitably come to the conclusion that you're going to have two lines in the statement of financial performance of associates and joint ventures, because some will have synergies, whereas some won't have that. And from the feedback I remember from the former project, it was something that was welcomed, as long as it was not a management view, but it was really a classification that was prescribed. Because it was giving an insight into how the profit was made. And I totally agree with what Martin said and Jean-Charles that you wouldn't, I mean, after, if we have in mind all the resistance that IFRS 11 has encountered when, you know, joint ventures were accounted for on the basis of the equity method, at the time there was discussion around the loss of information around the why the operating performance was made. So I think there are grounds, even beyond this, what we learned in this project, to provide this kind of insights. And it can still be isolated so that can we think differently.
Listening to this discussion, which has turned into a discussion about associates, which was a good one, I think that for me, the first comments that Nick made, which was about sort of how people are using EBIT, are what I would prefer using as our anchor for thinking about what we do with associates in particular, because if the whole point of coming up with this EBIT metric, I think, is because it's comparable, but it's also because we think it's a useful metric that's used in the market, and so we want to make sure that the formulation of it that we come up with actually can be used in a way that is useful, I guess. Having said all of that, I do agree with the idea of having the separate investing category, but I wonder, following on from what Tom said, until we've done some more thinking on the associate point, whether we need to sort of hold for the moment what the exact words might be rather than voting on them and locking them in today.
Okay. Mary?
I am hesitant to commit to saying yes, I want an investing category until I have a better idea of what it is that we're segregating to put into that. And so that's kind of the problem about, well, if you say you want it, we'll go off and develop further the criteria for what's in there. And obviously the treatment of associates is one of the big questions about that. But let me just check a very basic point. If we were to have an investing category, and maybe I'm peeking ahead a little to the next question that you have, I assume that that's something that would be below EBIT, given the nature of the items that you've identified as candidates for being in there, because the next question says expenses related to the entity's capital structure and interest on liabilities outside the capital structure, and since those are the eye of EBIT, investing would have to, if investing included those, it would have to be
examples in Appendix A, right? The investing.
Well, that's what I'm kind of struggling with, though, because if it includes interest expenses relating to the entity's capital structure, I don't see how that isn't.
Because I think, if I understand correctly, yeah, we're trying to find the marketable securities that aren't considered part of the capital structure because of your long-term investments as opposed to the sort of contra debt and have those up there.
Yeah.
And the ones that are sort of more liquidity and might be used to repay debt would be below.
Yeah. Okay.
Because what I came away from the paper, maybe I just wasn't parsing properly with the example in the back, is I'm very supportive of one thing that comes out of this, which is the notion of separating the kind of straight interest on debt type issues, type instruments from other financing type expenses, what some may regard as interest on operating, interest costs associated with operating items. And I think another one we're going to have to face up to is the unwinding of the discount on lease liabilities. You know, do you consider that more, a financing or non-financing? So basically, I struggled a bit to say, yep, I'm willing to say I think we needed an investing category until I understood what it would end up segregating. When I think I was misreading what you discuss in the next section, because I formed the incorrect conclusion about what might be investing, and I was struggling to put that together.
Yeah.
But I think there is virtue, and maybe this comes back to my basic point about more guidance about disaggregation, and maybe that's disaggregation of different types of financial type expense, and then the question is whether we have to collect them all in one place and label that as an investing category. So I think that kind of was driving me to saying maybe we need to focus a bit more on disaggregation guidance than on specifying lots and lots of specific line items.
Thank you.
I generally agree with the step recommendation. However, I need some clarification. If you see paragraph 15, B1, incorporating a wider view of excess cash and temporary or other excess cash. That's related to the discussion in paragraph 40 and 46. So that on that question, you are recommending not to revise any scope of this cash equivalent temporary. It seems to me these two questions are related to each other. So if we say here, yes, then we don't need to expand any scope of that cash equivalent. If you say no, then there will be another alternative to resolve this issue in paragraph 13, A and B, right?
Well, the staff recommendation to cash and cash equivalents is a stronger staff recommendation if we did bring in an investing category.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not necessarily suggesting the staff would change their view if we didn't have the investing category, but it would make it, I think, one of the reasons for bringing in the investing category were the concerns about that it would help relieve some of the concerns about not having that in capital structure. Because separating out, say, other liquid items that management might consider to be part of its cash management as a separate line item would mean that it could be added back if they wanted to.
What I'm saying is, as Tuck has suggested, maybe if we introduce a new category investing, we are getting closer and closer to the traditional operating profit concept.
Yeah.
So maybe in practice, maybe the feasibility of the maybe might be quite difficult to, maybe many prepared to think, to just have a kind of operating profit might be a quite difficult task for them to do. So what I'm saying is, I prefer this kind of approach. However, our discussion is going back to the original starting point. When we discuss whether we require EBIT or operating profit or some others. At the time, we said no. EBIT is much more easier to make a consensus among our stakeholders, but it's getting worse and worse. in terms of getting consensus. So that's what I'm saying.
That is, I suppose, one of the reasons why the staff says, let's not give the residual a name.
Yes, that's another point. But I don't think we just give up some alternative methods to resolve this issue. But I prefer this approach in introducing the investing category. But still, there are some other alternatives maybe we should consider in the future.
I think if we go down the discussion paper route, then we would obviously outline all the alternatives and get feedback on them all. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I think there is considerable sympathy for the idea of an investment category, but we need a bit more clarity on what it is. I don't know if you are helped much further by this, but but in principle, agree.
Take a vote on the station.
No. I think we can do two votes.
I think, yeah. Okay.
Three and four.
Okay, well, question 2B follows question 2A and is below paragraph 32. And the staff are recommending, consistent with having an investing category, we should define finance income and expenses to consist of and presented of the four line items, so income related to the entity's capital structure, expenses related to the entity's capital structure, interest expenses on liabilities outside capital structure, and interest income on a net defined benefit asset or a net asset when a liability outside capital structure qualifies for offset. Does the board have any view?
Thank you. I have very serious concerns about this. I think we are potentially creating a problem rather than solving one. This introduces considerable complexity and it goes way beyond what any user really is asking for. Conceptually, I can see the merit. I can understand absolutely the merit of trying to differentiate those financial items that are inherent to the group's operations and those which are part of capital structure. But as soon as we start to try and implement that, we get into difficulty straight away. So we have a working assumption in terms of treating all cash and cash equivalents as excess cash. We have to make an arbitrary assumption. We know that's clearly wrong right from the start. Every company needs some cash within it to oil the wheels, some liquidity on a day-to-day basis. We don't know if all the cash is operational or whether it's all excess. It's somewhere on a spectrum. But as an outsider, we have no way of judging where a company sits on that spectrum. So that's the first point that I think conceptually I can understand it, but from an implementation point of view, there's some very significant practical difficulties. I think the second point I'd make is this is part of our commitment to better communication. On one of those lines, we have labelled as interest income on a net defined benefit asset or a net asset that arises when a liability outside the capital structure qualifies for an offset with an asset. that fails straight away in my book, and it would fail most users, and most users would be throwing their hands up in the air at seeing something like that on the face of the performance statement. The third thing is really going back to, you know, what users are going to do with this number. And so I think they'll do three things with it, actually. They will use it as a building block, clearly, for their financial projections. They'll use it to tie back to a management performance number, which we'll discuss at a later date. But they will all do a margin number, and they'll want that number to be able to relate back to revenue as best they can. So I think we are producing a huge degree of complexity here beyond what's expected. I know the comments came back from feedback from users in terms of wanting to have an EBIT independent of capital structure, but I think what they meant by that, my interpretation, certainly the users I know, is that that'd be absence of finance income and expenses, full stop, not trying to differentiate the capital structure or the financial assets into operating and non-operating. I just don't see it's a place that we need to go and the market's asking for particularly.
So we can save ourselves a lot of trouble.
Potentially.
Tom?
Just similar to my last comment, is given what Nick said, but you know there were some reasons the staff built it like this, I think we need to do a bit more revisiting before we vote and try and clarify. I know we've spent a lot of time, but this is a really vital, important issue, I think, for everyone. So I think we always need to be absolutely certain, and if we've got doubts about the way users are going to use it or ought to use it, it's always possible for a user to be wrong. I just think that, like, I'm sympathetic again to the staff and what they've done, but if there are questions, I wouldn't mind just sort of keeping an open mind and recycling through some of our evidence a little bit before we finalize it.
Gary.
I actually agree with the staff on some questions A and B. I think for reasons other people have expressed, C and D need more work. For example, on D, interest expense and liabilities outside capital structure, you know, today's operating leases will be capital. I presume they would fit in this bucket. What's that? Would they?
Sorry.
Interest expense under the IFRS 16.
Leases. On the leases. I mean, in the previous paper, we were discussing leases being part of capital structure.
Yeah, well, first of all, I don't really agree with that, as you well know. but even that, I mean, they're to my way, the right of use assets and operational assets. I think we don't need to process. Now, I just think C and D need more processing. And if you're going to mention interest income and net defined benefit assets, I guess the next question, what about interest expense on, you know, defined benefit liabilities, you know, in it. Not every interest expense is created equal. Some are much more operational in nature, and some are more capital in nature. I think we should strive to keep this to capital. We might have a debate over what capital is, but I think it should be kept to what's capital.
I think I agree with not necessarily everything, but basically what Gary has said. So I'm very happy with A and B. I have second thoughts about C largely, and eventually D. So basically the reason is that I think what you introduce is a bit on the basis of let's provide a subtotal, a performance measure that allows to compare entities regardless how they're funded. And so A and B is therefore totally in place. And then it seems that the other elements are brought there because basically we would like to have all financial items beyond those that belong to investing here.
Actually, that we brought them there because at the moment the IFRS require the interest cost to be in financing for things like decommissioning liabilities. And so that was our reason for putting it there, just because we felt at the moment it made too much of a change to not be part of finance income and expense. But it was something we discussed in the June paper, the possibility that we could just restrict the finance income and expenses to capital structure. It would be a change that some of the standards require now.
We have consequential amendments. I'd rather have a good anchor, a good justification for that subtotal that I can describe economically, rather than trying to still comply with a little sentence in one of our standards that can easily be changed.
So,
I'm actually sympathetic and broadly supportive of where the staff was going, and I partly because I know the journey that we've sent you on to get here, and I sort of think that I still agree with the steps along the way. I think C is quite complex. I had to read it quite a few times to think about what would actually be in there, and so I think it is a bit of a communication challenge. But I guess it worries me a bit that Nick says this is over and above what the market would want or find useful, given it will be quite a burden for people to have to come up with all of these slices and dices. And so I'd be unfair and ask Nick, if you were given the free choice, how would you describe the I, if we were to give you the pen? Do you know off the top of your head?
So I think there are lots of things that I would include in myself, and I would have included time value of money in there with its decommissioning liability, and certainly the lease interest I would include. So it would be all encompassing, really. And certainly the one thing which I did welcome, I didn't mention it, was the proposal to clarify how we treat the net interest on pensions. That has been a long-term frustration for the market, and that then brings greater comparability than we have hitherto. So I think the market thinks as the I as an all-inclusive number. Clearly, some of the numbers, the time value numbers, fall out on the cash flow statement, and then non-cash movements, so that can be reconciled there. And I think if management feel very strongly that these are actually part of their inherent operations, that's when they use management performance measures to reflect those.
Is it the granularity that you think is a step too far? This idea of labelling things as capital structure and not?
I think it's very hard for us as outsiders just to take the cash question in particular. Whether the cash is operational or excess cash, it's actually impossible for us to say, to lay down a rule to say that all cash is excess cash. It doesn't bear scrutiny. So I think as an outsider, and I guess the last piece that worries me, I can see this, let's say this comes onto the face of the statement, I can see nonsense discussions between company management and investors in terms of what they see here. You know, so why is all your cash treated in this way? Well, it's not excess cash. We'll have miscommunication between corporates and investors for no good purpose whatsoever. Capital structure is often is frequently discussed already by investors, but I'm not sure this takes us forward in terms of helping get those right subtotals and the shape of the P&L, or certainly it wouldn't help inform that discussion in any way either, because we'd have straight away an erroneous assumption around the cash number.
So you're saying that you think it would be better for an entity to decide what would be in the capital structure, and they'd then make their own decision on whether the extent to which cash would be included in there or not?
I mean, you could do it through the eyes of management, but again, I think that's beyond what is it. I think this degree of differentiation within the interest line is not what the market is asking for.
Hey, John.
I'm sorry, I tried, struggling to understand the meaning behind all that. And I also read the last July or June board papers, because we have introduced some new terms. Capital structure, actually, I'm worried about the meaning. What's the meaning of capital structure? Because it's a new term come out, and when I was studied in university, I took the finance courses. Our teacher used a different understanding or different definition of capital structure. So I'm worried about that. If we introduce new term, we should be careful whether it could be clearly defined, clearly be understood, and clearly be implemented. Second one, it seems that it's not very strict, income related to, sometimes related to, it's very broad. Income related to, maybe every income operating, every income maybe relates to our capital structure, and in expense related to. So it's also very difficult to define what kind of thing we do not have, what's the meaning of income related to, what kind of income should be included in this count, and what kind of expenses. And the D, interest expenses on liability outside capital.
sometimes outside, maybe inside capital, what kind of thing? So what kind of outside? So I'm struggling because I know we are trying to find something which is finance income or finance expenses, but and we try to provide some discipline how to help prepare to provide those informations, but it should be, you know, very clearly defined and very easier for people for prepare to implement. So this is my concern. I agree we need some line item, but it should be carefully to be defined. Yeah.
I want to express a great deal of sympathy for Nick's not better communication characterization of item C in this line item, and that does make me think that we may be getting into the weeds a bit on that. But when I step back, thinking also about his concern about how would somebody try to use this information, I have heard, and it's a very unscientific sample, from a couple of investor meetings that I've been to, that they're very concerned about really trying to separate the capital structure interest from what they regard as the operating activity interest. And yes, there are going to be differences in views between what, you know, where you draw the line. And part of me says, if we, after consultation, conclude that it's worth forcing some disaggregation of interest expense into those two categories, somebody who says, I don't care about the disaggregation as a user would be able to just simply add them back, while somebody who feels it's important to separate out the kind of true capital structure, you know, if they have a vision that there's a true capital structure cost, they would find this disaggregation very, very useful to that. I think we'd have to admit up front that there, you know, that there's going to be a degree of judgment involved in making some of the distinctions subject to the guidance that we decide we provide. So I think that's important, and I think it's not just cash or non-cash, because, you know, if you think about accretion, you're still accreting to an amount that ultimately you're going to have to pay in future. It will be cash. It just isn't cash in this period. So I support the staff exploring this disaggregation of interest, and I think we have to remember that, to me, the key is, as we've been working on this, we are reminded of the pieces of interest that may be embedded in other line items further up the P&L, like employee compensation might include the interest, you know, sorry, I would have to go back and check IS 19. I don't want to make a stupid statement about where the interest is or isn't in today's P&L. But I think we keep being reminded about how an interest component might end up classified somewhere else in the P&L, and we may not be cognizant of it. And so I think in some ways this is a check going through the standards that have been written over the years, and thinking about whether there is an interest element that might be embedded, especially in a line item by function, and thinking about whether it really belongs in that function or whether it belongs more in a nature classified as interest. And then the further question is, if it does belong classified as interest, whether we should be seeking to disaggregate it between something that is called capital structure and something that is called operations. But I think the first thing is going through and thinking about what we might have left littered in the top half of the P&L, that when we think about separating out the I for EBIT, really belongs by nature down in interest. And then, you know, C, I think, was a good completeness check. But I would really hesitate to mandate a line like that. and I think at some point we get to an other. But we've got to reaffirm the point of this is to identify everything that's interest by nature and think about pulling it out and putting all the interest by nature in a single place.
Just briefly. I think Mary's point's a good one in terms of some of these items, financial items that have got into the operations, and the pension one's the excellent one because that's where companies today have choice, whether it's operational or financial under 19. They can decide. And that's been a huge bugbear for investors for many years, having that complexity, when everyone actually believes it should be in finance, straightforward, and don't regard it in operations in any way whatsoever. And again, it brings me to thought that, you know, that we, from a pragmatic point of view, that I don't see the need to differentiate the line in such a granular fashion. And certainly investors would welcome that we made sure that pension interest income was in finance going forward.
So,
and broadly rather than specifically thinking about C.
See if you catch them at the right moment.
The third section of the paper considers the interaction of our proposal with maybe the interaction with the cash flow statement. We'll talk about the investing.
I think probably question three is a sort of second order issue, then we'll go to four and hopefully have time for Denise's paper.
Yeah. So maybe if we have a look at section four, which relates to question four, which considers whether cash and cash equivalents is too restrictive as a proxy for cash and temporary investments of excess cash that form part of our definition of capital structure. I guess this question depends if we are supportive of going along the lines of introducing an investing category in the statement of financial performance, and the staff are recommending that we should retain cash and cash equivalents as a proxy for cash and temporary investments of excess cash in our definition of capital structure. Do the board agree?
So obviously I don't agree because I think it doesn't reflect the real world. And it actually extending it makes it even worse.
And what do we think is really the materiality of that number? It must be immaterial, right? Income from cash and cash equivalents. When what is that big?
At the moment,
I think a cash is. And I think the question is if you have excess cash or not is a big thing. But income from cash and cash equivalent, is that a big number which matters?
Can be.
Can be. But we want to separate all kind of it is invested in liquid securities, and this is all investing now, right?
That would be investing.
It's a small number. I cannot imagine that it's a big number.
More worried, not so much about the magnitude of the number, but you then start having this nonsense discussion between management and investors. So this is your defined as your excess cash, your cash and cash equivalent. Well, of course it's not. It can't be. We have to have cash to run the business.
But is your proposal then to put that into operations?
My proposal is not to differentiate between operational and non-operational financial items. Not to disintegrate with this, disaggregate with this degree of complexity.
So would it end up in the investing category?
But do you have to put it somewhere?
It could be in simply investment income.
This is one where I think I know where the cloud. I mean, it's fairly standard to take cash that's really excess, and I went back when we had that significant synergies, and what I would. If I looked at a investment in any marketable liquid security, put that provisor in there, and I posed the question, if you sold it tomorrow, and paid a special dividend, would it affect operations? And in many cases, it wouldn't affect operations one iota because it truly is excess cash. And I'm assuming that's kind of what the staff are trying to get at. And it is certainly, I've seen presentations and stuff where people were recommending a takeover where they did exactly that when they worked out the cost of capital and estimated everything. So some people do that. Other people don't, which is why I'm really troubled right now in terms of going forward. I think this goes back to us trying to sort out the earlier problems. I'm not sure it's that worthwhile to rehash, because based on our earlier discussions, we're not quite there still. I'm still not there because I'm just not confident that I want to take that out or leave it in at this point.
Based on the definition of the investing category that we end up with?
Yeah, these are all bound up now. But given everything everyone said, these have to be bound up, and we have to, I think, sort them out and ideally come to a fairly strongly shared consensus. And then we're going to go out to the world and be told a million different things. And so I just, before we go to the world, let's try and get as solid a position as we can.
I would think, why is it important to differentiate, as you said, if we have it at capital structure, yes or no, or we have it at, if we have an investing category, and then this kind of income from this stuff in investing, I would be happy with that. Because I really think it is a small number, and then to distinguish and have the discussion, is it free cash or no, because some we say, okay, this should belong into the capital structure and not to the operations. I understand that, but would it be a big deal to have that in investing? I don't see that. And because, is it right? Because we are proposing that all liquid securities are in investing, right? And I think it's always difficult to see, okay, what is the boundary between this cash and cash equivalents and then investing in that in liquid securities? Kind of artificial differentiation. Yeah,
the artificial runs through this.
Mary?
It doesn't lead me to an answer, but and I have a feeling I'm just not getting something about this section and what the implications are. But two things that struck me is, one, I can't tell if the staff is saying we might try to create a difference between the statement of cash flows and the statement of performance in terms of disaggregating the statement of performance about what we determine to be cash and cash equivalents. And just a general hesitation that the more complexity we introduce, if we're heading down a road that would say cash and cash equivalents means this for the purpose of the statement of cash flows, but it might mean something different for the purpose of disaggregating our performance statement, then that raises the complexity alarm to me generally.
The purpose was to have the same.
Okay. So that if we're not, I think it would need overwhelming evidence to move me off of that we have to do that, because I think we don't want to start messing around with the statement of cash flows unless we absolutely need to. So if it's saying it may not be perfect, but let's not start messing with that, messaging it that way would help. And the other is if and only if we are looking at changing it, changing what we consider, then I would say one of the first things I'd say to think about is, are there differences today between how we treat this and U.S. GAAP treats it? Because if we are looking at changing it, then that's one of the inputs I'd like to consider. I don't want to start pursuing that just for the sake of another snippet of convergence along the way.
Just looking at using the cash and cash equivalents definition the same and just using it as part of the capital structure definition.
And that's how it evolved, because what we were originally trying to do was to say, well, we were told by users they want an EBIT subtotal that's independent of capital structure. So we then said, well, how do we go about defining capital structure? Well, obviously it's the liabilities and the interest expense on those liabilities that are part of capital structure. But hold on a second, if somebody's holding quite a bit of cash, they might want to count that as part of the capital structure because it effectively reduces the amount of the liabilities that they have. And we say, well, how would we go about defining that excess cash? Well, the easiest way to do it would be to lean on what we've got in IS 7, which is about cash and cash equivalents, and use that as the proxy for the excess cash. We know it's not perfect, and we know it doesn't necessarily reflect the position the entity has, but we thought it was a simple and pragmatic approach to that.
So you're saying basically treat all cash and cash equivalents as part of capital structure, rather than saying there's a slice that you've got to allocate.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay.
That's all.
I had a hard time reading that from this, and I think that might just have been my brain processing badly.
I mean, obviously, I think Tom had raised it at a previous meeting that this phenomenon is probably most obvious with a number of US companies in terms of having very high cash holdings at the moment. But really going through their reports and their transcripts, this isn't something that they seek to bring out in a particular way to differentiate which is generating an operating return and which is generating a financing return. That conversation simply doesn't happen. They just say, this is the cash, this is what it has earned, end of. No one's trying to say, actually, we think of this part of our operational cash and it's generating an investment return, and this is the other cash. Doesn't happen in the marketplace.
Gary?
Yet, a while ago, a year or two ago, we had discussions about net debt. Is this, we're talking about which cash should we subtract? Are you using this the same light as that? Pretty much, okay.
It's similar, and I think the reason why we were going for the cash and cash equivalents was to try and avoid a lot of the debate that we had around the net debt.
So the problem is cash equivalents are not all created equal. There's cash, there's short-term investments, and then there's some longer, slightly longer-term investments. So maybe my question is, some of these companies that have got hundreds of billions of dollars in cash in there, I mean, it's excess, to be sure. And not clear what are we subtracting that in here, or is it just the...
We tended to follow the similar definition for IS7, which I think really has a more short-term,
That you would.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact word.
So I think that the overall objective, from what I understood, it was in effect you get to an interest expense number that's net of interest income on these cash and close to cash type investments.
Yeah.
That's all you're trying to do.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
In actually, okay with that. The question is, what's close to cash or cash equivalents.
But it won't matter.
If you're subtracting it, it would, I think.
Cash equivalents are short-term, highly liquid investments that are readily convertible into a known amount of cash and which are subject to an insignificant risk of changes in value.
So if everything was in that bucket or just regular cash, you would subtract the whole amount? If all the interest, 100% of the interest earned on would be reduction in this. Seems a bit too restrictive, really. I mean, I'm okay in the general principle, but companies do actually have a working capital float requirement. Might be excess that you didn't pay a bill for it today, but you need, whether you call it the rainy day fund or just you collect your receivables 6 weeks later on average, and you have to do your payables, but they need working cash. And I'm not sure what the solution is. I'm sort of broadly on board with VR, but I think it needs a bit more development because I don't think it should be 100% of these amounts subtracted.
Wouldn't it be easier just to put it all in the investor?
I think it's aligned with Gary's question in here. So I think it's your response and Gary's construction helped me out a little bit with my thought. But taking into consideration what Nick said and the fact that in the real world no one does that. And apparently, at least the one who has more experience in dealing with companies under the eyes of investors actually doesn't see this as really useful. If we don't do that, what would be the outcome of the model that you have in mind?
Well, we could put them all in the cash and cash equivalents, consider it in the investing category. I think that would be something we should bring back to the next meeting.
And then you'll bring back more?
When we look at how we define the investing category, one thing we could consider is having the cash, the income expense on the cash and cash equivalent that we were considering part of capital structure to be part of the investing category as well.
Okay, would it aligned with cash flow, right?
Pardon?
Would be aligned with cash flow?
I think we need to bring our proposal back for the cash flow as well if we be discussing the investing category.
That's a difficult for me. I think we are derailing a little bit, and the model is becoming complex and unclear, and what we're going to land.
Okay, so the staff wants to bring this back?
Probably, I think maybe if we move on to the next page. Yeah.
With the pros and cons of each. With the pros and cons of keeping it here or moving it back.
Okay, let's do that.
Okay, let's move on to the next paper, agenda paper 21B. This paper identifies and discusses four main problems with the requirements in IS-1 presentation of financial statements. For the presentation of an analysis of expenses using the function of expense method or the nature of expense method. And this paper also summarizes the staff research and the outreach, the feedback we receive on the outreach on the use of those two methodologies, and this summary is presented in Appendix A of this paper. These results suggest that the guidance in IS-1 is often ignored or misinterpreted. So in paragraph 3 of this paper, we provide some recommendations to the board for improving the requirements in this respect. And we think that these recommendations would meet the needs of the preparers that produce the analysis of expenses and of the users that use that information. So we have included some questions as part of our staff analysis. And if you agree, I would like to refer to each one of these questions and ask the board to provide its views. So I'm conscious about the time, and I will try to be a little bit quick by introducing each one of these issues. So I would like to start with issue 1, analyzing paragraphs 36 to 48 of this paper. So the question that we are analyzing is, should the board describe the meaning of function and of nature? And more specifically, I think the question we're asking is, should the board describe the meaning of a function of expense method and of nature of expense method? So the staff proposal is that yes, the board should probably consider including descriptions of the nature of expense method and of the function of expense method. And our proposed descriptions are in paragraphs 47 and 48 of this paper. So our question below paragraph 48 of this paper is, do you agree with our proposed description? Well, first of all, do you agree that we have to provide some descriptions of these two methodologies? And secondly, do you agree with our proposed descriptions?
Yes, I agree. We should define them. Much of this project, if not almost all of it, is about comparability. And if the P&L has got basically two important sections, revenue, and it's got costs and expenses, which seem to me trying to get some clarity of definition around, be it function and or by nature, is exactly what we should be doing. I mean, I don't know that we need to. I'm okay with the words as written here. I suspect we could process them and words them a bit more, but I think they hit the essence of what we need to do.
Jack?
Thank you. I agree with staff's recommendation that we should define what's the function and what's the nature. And especially, I appreciate the word in the definition of function that combines the expense items. So that's exactly what the function is all about. But one concern is the last word in the paragraph 48. It says these expenses all arise from the entity's production activities. It implies that only the manufacturer could use the function that by function presentation. But many retailers or many traders uses presentation by function. So therefore, using the term production may be misleading. Maybe it's just, when you purchase goods to sell, then this is the cost of sales. So I don't have any suggestion at this moment, but at least we should avoid simply using production activity.
Well, I appreciate your concern. It was just meant to be an example, and in line with the example that we were including there, we thought that the activity that combines all these items
is combined is
activity,
fine.
Thinking about the manufacturing entity, precisely.
That was within the example.
In the context of the example.
All right. Yes. Can we go to question one? Okay, slam dunk.
Well, subject to some words.
Okay, moving on to issue two, analyzing paragraphs 49 to 52 of this paper. The question we are asking is, should the board eliminate the choice between methods for presenting an analysis of expenses? The staff proposal is that the board retains the choice for presenting an analysis of expenses because, on the basis of our feedback and outreach and research, preparers and users find both methodologies useful. However, we think that the board should consider adding more guidance on how an entity makes its choice of methodology and how that choice is applied. So our proposals to add more guidance are in paragraph 51A and B, and our questions below paragraph 52 are based on whether the board agrees to retain the choice and whether the board agrees to add more guidance. So do you have any comments?
Anne? I think that we have to allow that choice to be there. We're dealing with entities that are very different and choose to present their information, want to present their information in very different ways. So I think the answer to the first question is yes. However, we are trying to tidy up presentation and improve presentation. So it would make sense to try and do some things that add some more discipline. And it seems that there is a lack of information about why people do it, and also some lack of compliance with IAS-1, with requirements in IAS-1 to say when you are going by function that an additional description by nature is required. And we can see entities are not complying with that. So that's something that we need to focus on, and that can come out of point two there.
Mary.
I am supportive of the staff's direction, but I want to think about a couple things. One is how we communicate it. I don't think we are suggesting retaining, quote, a choice, but I think we're retaining, the proposal is to retain two different approaches, but require entities to make a choice that is the most useful. So that's, if we characterize it as a choice, it sounds like a free choice, and that's not what you're suggesting. I support what you're suggesting, which is that we continue to have two approaches, but require entities to use the one that they believe provides the most useful information. I do not agree with the proposal in the paper to require an entity to disclose why it has made the choice it makes. I think if we give them a benchmark that says you've got to do the one that is most useful, and that we've given them that benchmark to do it, and I think we're just adding to the disclosure. Sometimes we rely too much on disclosure as the discipline. But let's just say that that's the requirement, and if they get challenged, that they then have something they have to be able to explain, whether it's to their auditors or to their regulator or both. And I think the last thing is, I think this echoes what Anne was saying, is I think currently, at least before you get to income taxes, we notionally require a single method to be used, and some of the evidence you produced about the extent to which people are mixing and matching is, I think, verges on non-compliance with existing requirements rather than being something that we have to amend. So let's be careful, your language on page 14 in B,
is it speaks as if we're introducing for the first time a requirement to use a single method, and I don't think that's consistent with our standards, although we have highlighted both some functional challenges, operational challenges in meeting current requirements. So I think, again, just be careful about how you're messaging that.
Well, I also agree with the recommendations proposed. Now, I mean, to follow up on the issue of whether you can really strictly be one or the other, I think you can always be by expense, by nature. But when you get to having an analysis by function, and for example, you want to highlight a certain number of non-recurring items, this will be by nature. There won't be so mandating that necessarily everything is allocated to functions would not, in my view, provide relevant information. So I can support that we eventually better define the current requirements. We affirm them, or so that there is indeed discipline, more discipline. But I think saying it's 100% allocated, I think it's not feasible.
Martin?
Yeah, I agree with the first question, but not with the second, because I think this disclosure will not add, will not provide discipline. It will be boilerplate explanation, and we should not go with it.
Okay. Do you think we should require people to pick the one that they think is most useful?
Yeah.
Is it just the disclosure you object
but not,
to?
But not explaining why.
Thank you. I agree with the step recommendation number one and two. Same feeling. Let's see the single method on paragraph 51B. As Mary said, you know, might be cause some problems. If you see your paper A19A, US regulation SX specifically required a mixed approach rather than a single method. So but you have some kind of a phrase here if there is an exception. However, what I'm saying is that another country is requiring a mixed presentation method rather than just one single method. So,
but I think that's just for U.S. GAAP reporting companies.
Yeah, I understand, but there is some reason why they ask that kind of mixed representation. Maybe mixed presentation method might be more relevant to maybe investors. Oh, yeah.
I think it goes back to some of that information that's missing from the function
mm-hmm.
element.
I see.
So I agree that we should, sorry, I want to say retain the choice, but I like the way that Mary expressed it in terms of the appropriate approach for the entity. I'm more ambivalent about the second question, I have to say, because it would only have any impact if it did change behaviours. I'm not sure investors would read the disclosure. Particularly, they would skim through it. I'm more on the fence with that one.
Is question two disclosure, or is it more putting requirements in this, in the proposing putting in place specific things people need to apply when they make their selection?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Not disclosure.
Well, the intention was that they would disclose the reasons why they.
I didn't read question two that way.
Yeah, I don't see that.
I didn't read question two that way.
Yeah,
setting criteria as opposed to disclosing.
Doug?
Thank you. I'm not happy with keeping choice. I think we should require some default format. And looking at the nature of financial statement, having a performance reporting by nature is somehow already default, because if you look at the bookkeeping in trial balance, normally they have expense by nature. So then the only the thing is whether or not you are required to combine it so that you can provide some function of your company. And in most cases, other than financial institution, the financial information performance reporting by function is useful, like we discussed before. So therefore, as long as you are ordinary company, you are required both by nature and by function. So basically, you have to prepare everything by nature and combine it by function. And you have to provide the disaggregation of each functions. So for example, cost of sales, you have to provide depreciation, labor cost, and others. So we can require it, although I understand you mentioned that the pushback from the preparers, and you show the example of, say, IT expense. Once you put it in IT expense, you cannot really disaggregate. I understand that, but I think it's just the excuse. It's just a matter of data processing. So it's not a significant issue. It's not a fundamental issue. Of course, they need to change the system a little bit, but it's just a matter of data processing. In the beginning, normal company has the expense by nature. So only the question is how you combine and when you combine. So looking at the current development of the IT system, so it's not impossible at all. So what we could do is you have to provide the expense by nature, but you have to provide the by function basis based on your business model. And if your business model is totally irrelevant to the by function type presentation like a financial institution, then you can provide it only by nature. So it should be a conditional choice.
Amaro.
Excellent. I agree with paragraph with one as well. I think I'm the same camp as Martin and Nick. The second one, I really don't agree. I think there are two aspects, at least in my mind. I think management commentary and other information that in the financial report will provide the reasons why the presentation was in that fashion. And another one is on disclosure. We are still discussing disclosure overload and creating another disclosure that might be that beneficial. I don't think it's reasonable.
I misspoke before because I've seen that. Reading 51, it does have disclosure. So I agree with keeping the ability to select the classification that's the most appropriate using Mary's articulation, which I liked. And what I do agree with, I don't think we need to have a disclosure, but what I would agree with is making it clear with criteria that put some discipline around that selection with this sort of anchor to what's useful for users of the financial statements. And while I sort of agree with not having too much mixing and matching, I think that Francoise raised a fair point. It's not just where we ask for specific items to be singled out for special attention, which can sort of create tensions, but also with some of the work we might be going to do on the management performance metrics, there may be other things that we're encouraging people to strip out. So I think we just have to be careful not to create our own disconnect within our own decisions.
So just to clarify, so you are agreeing with what we say in paragraph 52, that we didn't do it in this paper, but perhaps it would be better to develop criteria that entities could follow to determine that.
But not using the word choice. So I liked Mary's.
Yeah, I understood. I understood.
Yeah, I just in paragraph 51B, sort of I'm mindful of what Chung Wu said, that the SEC has a please do a mix for us. So we say this requirement would apply except where natural or functional line items are mandated by AS1 or either IFRS standards, or where the entity supplements its analysis. I'm just wondering how many, given what the SEC said, and how many exceptions are there that do we really want to say you got to do one or the other if these things may turn out to be numerous? Because if they're numerous, you basically have three categories. And I don't know. For example, research comes to mind. I think research is a function. We require the disclosure of research and development as an aggregate, but arguably you could separate them. Development's a function too. So I'm assuming that standard doesn't go away, so we're going to be doing some functional building, even in a nature one. We're going to take some of the salaries, some of the lab space, some of the supplies, and we'll show them something called research. And I just want to make sure before we go down this, it's the one or the other, that mixed thing doesn't. In other words, isn't it going to be just cheaper for the firm with big research activities to take that calculation that we say they have to do and put it on the income statement? There's also some evidence to suggest that research as an aggregate number is a highly informative, relevant number, better than taking the salaries and the lab space and spreading it across by nature. So I just want to make sure before we go there that that's the solution. And I think, I don't know, Chung Wu, if you had a view, but I thought that was kind of, I'm not sure where the SEC, do you remember exactly where they tell you to do this?
I don't know about the existence of such practice and regulation. I say something and just say there may be some reason why they're asking.
The paper identifies the source as the details of regulation SS.
Yes. Yeah, well, just to mention in addition that the SEC doesn't really define what function is or nature is, but in practice when you see the minimum line items required by this regulation, you see that it's a combination of what we would consider functional lines and not, and I, sorry for using the term functional, Mary, but the items by nature and items by function. So that could be interpreted for us, under IS1, as a kind of a mixed approach, just to pick and choose of several different types of lines. Now, you were, just to further clarify that sentence in paragraph 51B, And the phrase "this requirement would apply except where a specific natural functional line items are mandated by IS1. It's just we were thinking about the case where an entity would choose to provide information by nature as their primary analysis, but then there would be another requirement in some other standard, or even a minimum line item required in IS1 that is by function. So then in that case, you would have functional line items and you would have natural line items, even though you chose as a primary analysis, analysis by nature. So that's what we were implying here. And I'm sorry that it was a little bit confusing. But the idea, the main idea in this section is to say, well, just let's keep the choice the choice that is more appropriate for the entity, and that should be the main or primary analysis of expenses. And then, based on your choice, then you would follow the requirements specifically for that choice. So if you choose by function, then you would have inevitably to provide a further analysis by nature, because that's required. And it's not a mixed... So
I think most people seem to be saying they agree with the sort of basic idea that it shouldn't just be a pick or choose, there should be one primary driver.
That's right.
Subject to acknowledging that in some cases there may be a need to depart from that. So I think we have to be very careful how we articulate it. I think
yes.
Your point's fair, Tom. Mm-hmm. But could we maybe vote on that basis that we agree with the approach? Please don't make me try and re-articulate that again. Hopefully you understood it the first time round. On one for question one, and then on question two, that we agree with this sort of idea of you choose what's the most appropriate from a user perspective. Give some pointers on how you do that, but we don't go so far as requiring disclosure of why you made the selection that you did. Can we vote on those two?
Yes.
I just have a choice.
Okay. One applicant and one.
Yeah.
And so you're only actually disagreeing on the vote on question one, not on the vote on question two.
Yeah.
I know we took them together, but
he agreed on two.
Agreed on two.
Yeah.
Okay, so moving on to issue three, analyzed in paragraphs 53 to 57. The question we are asking is, should the board retain the requirement to provide additional information on the nature of expenses when choosing a function of expense method? The staff proposal is that the board retains this requirement, existing requirement in IS1, because users find this further disaggregation by nature useful. However, this requirement should only apply when an entity is able to provide an analysis by nature that is consistent and non-arbitrary. The staff proposes that if the entity cannot supply a by function and further by nature analysis, an entity should be required instead to provide an analysis by nature. And the staff is of the view that the board should require, in addition, the staff is of the view that the board should require by function information if this is used internally by management. So for an entity choosing an analysis by nature and uses the analysis by function internally, then this analysis will be presented. So our questions below are below paragraph 57 and ask the board if the board agrees with these two proposals.
Gary, you were keen to get in?
Actually, I agree with you on this. I think it's important someplace, footnote, I jump ahead a bit, I would prefer a footnote, but to detail out the operating the natural expenses of the company, you know, labor, materials, you know, overheads, and so on. I think that's useful. And by the way, I think at the instance of recording the transaction in the ledger, it comes through as payroll. It comes through as, you know, utilities expense and so on. So the combination of that plus the department roles, so you'll sort of know is the labor associated with IT and so on. So I think it's useful and I think it's important. And with some work, I think it's actually quite doable to itemize in some degree your operating expenses. Rolling it to function. And I think your question 3B is if it's used by management, I think we got to get more precise, like at the CODM. The chances are everything is used by somebody at some level. And most big companies are a matrix. And sometimes you look by nature, sometimes by geography, sometimes by function. They all get used for different purposes. So I think by management, I think you got to be thinking in terms of CODM type level, consistently used as opposed to a one-off analysis. In it. Still, even if you go to expenses by nature, payroll versus everything else. Well, if you had on roll research people today that are in your labor base, you contract it out tomorrow, you outsource them, and now you have a service bill, but it's still 98% labor and probably people used to work for you. You have to deal with, is that a service cost or is that a pseudo labor cost? I mean, it's not going to be that easy to do. It's probably easy to do. It's probably not so easy to get the comparability across a lot of entities that you want. And though I'm jumping a bit ahead, I think with XBRL coming and all this, you know, electronic reporting, I don't think it matters if it's a footnote or if it's in the face of the primary statements going back to competent probably 2 hours ago. I think the P&L, we should think of as a structured summary and the details follow behind.
Yeah, if I understood well, the way we have voted before so that there would be criteria that would guide the choice, then I'm not sure that we need to these recommendations any longer. Because if it's, in fact, two possibilities, but the choice is no longer a free choice. Basically, I'm not sure we still have the scope for that.
Although on the second part, wasn't this sort of providing a different cut?
Yeah, well, you mean 3B?
Yeah,
well, 3B is just raising the fact that currently IS1 does not require further information by function when entities provide an analysis by nature. So we raise the question, should entities be required to provide this? And then we we just came up with this idea, well, if it's used internally by management, then probably it should be required to be presented somewhere.
But if we have criteria that lead the entity to have to present by function, they're going to have it by function. And if they do not meet the criteria, even if they provide, I mean, in the case they would have it internally, when they do not meet our criteria, why would we want them to provide it?
Well, maybe thinking about that case, maybe the entity would not be able to or will not be willing to provide that information because it's not used internally by them.
So maybe I didn't understand how we voted on the previous one. I thought we retained the two presentations, but would develop criteria that would guide the entity into the choice they would make.
Please do not get confused. Issue two, refers to the primary analysis the first choice made by the entity. And this is, issue three is talking about the secondary analysis, the additional analysis presented. So IS1, if you choose by function, requires a secondary analysis by nature. But when you choose an analysis by nature, it's silent. It doesn't tell you if you need a further analysis by function.
Forget about me, I will understand later.
Mary? You're stopping?
Okay. Yeah, no, I've now confused myself, so I want to look at this again before I ask a question.
Tom?
Yeah, let's see if I ask a question, and then I have a comment. So when they do function, we want them to provide nature in the notes. Do we want them to do this as an aggregate by nature, or to take each functional item and split it to the natures?
Sorry, just to be a bit more precise, it's not that we are requiring them to provide a further analysis by nature. That is already a requirement.
Yeah,
we would keep.
Okay, all right.
Nice what? One. Okay. So we keep it, but sorry to interrupt you, but the question is, when an entity, based on the evidence that we've seen in the past, because we have not tested that right now, to be completely honest, if the entity is unable to provide that allocation of nature expenses to the functions identified, is unable to provide this additional information by nature on a consistent and non-arbitrary basis, then should we still require that information or not?
Okay, but I still have my question.
Sorry, yes.
Which is, when we say, so I have a big functional income statement, say it has cost of sales and SG&A, just keep it simple, two things. Do the nature things take the cost of sales and do all the natures for cost of sales and then do all the natures for SG&A, or do they just say, here are our natures for cost of sales and SG&A aggregated? Is either okay? Is that a choice?
Well, I think it's the first option that you gave. You have to provide a disaggregation of the function.
Each line.
So it's a nice tree diagram.
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that. Okay, that makes sense to me. I do have a question about this assumption. The sentence then, in the bottom of paragraph 56. Their view is the nature of expense method is generally considered more useful than a function of expense method. And the example I just gave of research, I would argue that research is more useful than taking the things and disaggregating them. Disaggregating might be useful, but only disaggregating them as research. So here's the research salaries, here's the research lab expense, here's the research. If you just took the salaries and plunged them in with the other salaries, I think you'd lose a lot of information. And I'd also say that there's a lot of evidence that one of the most used elements is simply gross profit. That line, which is a functional line, is highly correlated with all the firms that use a gross profit line with what happens. And I don't know that it's obvious to me that replacing it with a nature line would produce better information. I think we're back to what we said to the first thing, that the organization should choose the one that they think better depicts. And I'm not convinced that we should have this assumption running, because I'm not sure how it holds. Like, how much evidence do we have that the nature is clearly better across the board?
We're not actually saying that we think nature is better across the board. I think what we're saying is that when doing your primary analysis, you need to decide which, by function or by nature, provides the most useful information. So in the scenarios where you're talking about, where something like research is considered to be useful, something like gross profit is considered to be useful, we would expect the entity to choose a by-function presentation. But I think what we've also heard from some of our outreach is that even when you have a by-function analysis, the users of the financial statements find a by-nature breakdown to be useful in addition to that. So
if it's the tree, I totally support it. If it's kind of a rebuttable substitution almost, that was my concern. Okay, so if it's a tree, I'm great. Thank you. Sorry.
Okay. Jin Chao?
I support and understand the intention, try to provide additional information with regard to the by function information beyond the by main nature of the expenses. Yes. The one question, because the reason why because we say that why the prepare they use the nature of expense method, the reason is that they are unable to allocate the nature component to different functions. I understand that this is the main reason behind that. So I'm not sure for those companies that adopt IFIs, which kind of company really unable to allocate those expenses to different functions? Because if it's difficult to allocate those expenses, how can they get the number of sales or the cost? And, or even, it seems to me it's a little bit of contradiction to the discussion with the primary financial statements. Yes. Because we are trying to bring some subtotals or different categories based on function. Yes. And we acknowledge that that's a mixed model, not only by the nature, also by the function. So it seems the company should do that. And if we look at this one, seems that those companies could not do by the function. So it's quite confusing. Which kind of company they cannot do that? They're unable to do that. And we use a word of arbitrary. Because we have different standards, has established different discipline for that, inventory standard IS2 or PPE or borrowing costs, we have IS23 to try to try to prescribe what those expenses should be allocated, should be allocated to the cost of the inventory or cost of the other thing. So I'm not sure for those companies they can adopt IFIs fully, why they cannot allocate those expenses to different functions. And so this is the reason is correct.
I think we're talking about different things here. As we pointed out in our analysis in A18 of the paper, in the method preferences by industry, and A19, there are some industries that because they've got one single function at the most, or two single functions, or very small, or one predominant function like the banking services, utilities, healthcare, that they do not choose to provide an analysis of expenses by function. They just prefer to provide an analysis by nature. So it's not that they cannot provide an analysis by function, it's just that, it's not worth it for those industries to do that analysis, because in a manufacturing company, it is possibly better to provide an analysis by function because they've got several different functions and activities within their business. So we're talking about different types of business and the reasons why they make the choices that they make. That's one thing. But the other thing, the other point, completely different point that we are raising, and that's explained in paragraph A17 in the appendix, is that some preparers argue, and this is still something that we need to test if we issue a discussion paper, argue that they are that they just lose track of the nature of the expenses. So when in their systems, when they input all their items into their systems to produce the financial statements. So I think at first, obviously, they've got expenses by nature, but then their systems identify several functions, and then to further disaggregate again those functions by nature is what is difficult because they just lose track of the original function, if you will. That's what that's the feedback that we got in the previous financial statement presentation project. That was, 7 years ago? Maybe there have been some advances in technology nowadays in the systems, and maybe that's not the case anymore. Maybe it's too early to say, too early to require entities to use by nature if you cannot allocate by nature expenses to the functions. Maybe we need to get more feedback in that respect, maybe, to see if entities are really able to provide that information.
So this is the next suggestion with the B, issue 3B, because we believe they are unable. So that is why we come out to the B. If internally they are using kind of data that you can, they should provide, provided information by function. My suggestion that this kind of thing really exists. If though this reason does not exist, we should require. Because once those companies, they provide expenses by function, they have been required to provide information by nature in the notes. Why not? Why those companies, they provide information about by nature on the face, why they have option to provide those information by function in notes or not? So I'm thinking that we should have very, founding solid concept behind those disclosure requirements and do not leave any, flexibility for them. Yeah, because otherwise, okay, it's based on the internal management, because they say that we're unable to allocate those information to different functions. So, okay, even we require them based on current proposal, ECO3B, they can also argue if that reason, that reason does exist.
I think all we're trying to do with B is to say that there could be some situations where it's been quite a difficult call for an entity to decide whether by nature or by function provides the most useful information. And in fact, in their own internal reporting purposes, they're using both sets of information. And all we're saying here is, okay, having made the decision that you're going to do by nature, if actually you look at by function as part of your sort of management control, then we would like you to also disclose that information. That's all we're trying to get at with B.
Mary.
Okay. On this question, I have a feeling that we're combining a couple different thoughts. I think the observation in paragraph 56 about if you can't do it on a consistent and non-arbitrary basis, then that is a pointer for nature of expense. It's something that really belongs in our last discussion. And so my suggestion is that we take paragraph 56 and regard it as an indicator back there and not kind of take it as a vote. We currently have a requirement that says if you do by function, you've got to provide by nature in a supplemental analysis. We haven't heard anything that suggests that we should take it away. People are telling us it's useful, and we haven't heard a huge uproar that it's
you know, really, really costly and excessive. So let's keep that. Then the question of whether we introduce symmetry so that if you do a nature, that you also be required to do function. I think let's not go there. I haven't seen in this paper something that says this is the reason why, as opposed to it's just kind of natural symmetry. And I think, you know, Gary said in his original comment, we'd have to start specifying, like, who uses it, how often, et cetera, if we want to write it as a requirement. And I think we're kind of piling on to what we should be trying to streamline as a project. And I think especially if you go back to changing it from a free choice to a, you've got to do the thing that is most useful. If somebody has all the front of the document analyzing things by function, and yet they present it by nature P&L, that somebody's going to start asking some questions sooner or later about that. So I'd say let's leave that be. So in terms of your two questions, I think the first one is just move it to guidance, and the second one is I don't support staff recommendation to propose requiring it.
Martin?
I agree with Mary, and for maybe a different reason, because this project name is Primary Financial Statements and not Notes. And my thoughts is, okay, that we should get a better primary financial statements, which if we have problems with expenses, that we give more guidance, okay, what we expect entities should show on the face, but not in the notes. And I think we should focus on this guidance, on not solving disclosure problems, which I am not sure if they're really existing.
Yeah.
If it is by function, we should maybe say, okay, as we have said, if it is your primary more useful for investors, you would use that. If nature is, you would use that, and then maybe give some minimum what we expecting then, but not dealing with additional analysis.
I agree with Martin. I think to give just a breakdown of the total expenses, regardless of which functional line item it rolls to, I think is doable. It's once you start trying to allocate it to functions, I would say do not start underestimating the issues with shared services and how much common costs are in those things. And the way they get allocated internally, in a perfect world, it would be what would look like in a standalone basis. The chances are it's anything but a perfect world, and it gets to internal capabilities. You will allocate overhead. Sometimes it's on headcount. Sometimes it's on direct labor cost. Square footage, the list goes on. At the same time, those dynamics change, and part of this is part of internal budgeting. It gets to the relative negotiating power of executives for their group, and so on and so on. So in terms of consistent and non-arbitrary, I got my doubts about how uniform we could try to enforce that. So again, I fully support breaking out all the expenses by nature. And again, once you start trying to go beyond that, if it's not otherwise already done, I think we start running into problems and the cost benefit comes pushing back. You know, certainly in my old industry, but by no means the only industry, I mean, the heavy focus was on what's your gross profit or your gross margin, depending on how you look at it, because it goes like, if your gross profit is 40% and your overheads are 15%, that says I got 25% to invest in R&D and share rebuybacks or whatever else you want, or buy companies. That got to be a focus. What is the gross margin? It's beyond that, it gets heavily discretionary. And so you try to grow the absolute dollars, but the focus was the functional gross profit. And then beyond that, it was got to be somewhat discretionary, maybe you subtract overheads. But then after that, it's share buyback, it's R&D, it's acquisitions, whatever. That becomes your available amount of revenue. And heavy analytical focus by users on that number.
Nick?
I think from a user perspective, it's hard to say that one approach is better than the other. Certainly some, and these things tend to congregate around certain industries. It becomes an industry standard in the market. Just does that, which I think is fine. The little bit that I'm troubled by is the non-compliance with the existing requirements. And I think what we're trying to do is tighten up on that in here, perhaps a little with too much. But do we have a route if we to ensure that those items, which I think are depreciation, amortization, employee costs, are allocated by function, those natural items. Is that the, am I right in saying that's the existing requirement and it's not being complied with?
Well, when you choose by function, the only item that is currently required is cost of sales. But then there is a general requirement that you have to provide a disaggregation of that, or an allocation of natural items to that to the functions. But it doesn't tell you necessarily that you have to disaggregate depreciation and taxation.
Okay, so it's a...
When you provide analysis by nature, there is a requirement to disaggregate depreciation and amortization in paragraph 103 or 104. So to your question, yeah, I think the requirement is not clear, to disaggregate depreciation and amortization. Specifically, yeah.
Shall we have a vote?
I think we probably need to take them separately.
Yes.
I think there was some suggestion about the idea about part A actually being more of an indicator of the fact that the by function analysis would not be an appropriate basis rather than something a specific requirement. I think that's quite a sensible idea. So perhaps if we could change that to sort of say in our guidance about choosing between the sort of selecting between the different function and nature, the fact that you can't make a not, the fact that you it's difficult to make a non-arbitrary allocation to the functions would be an indicator that you should use the nature basis. So could we take a vote on that one first?
Just change it to indicator.
Change it to an indicator of by nature would be preferable.
But do we know that sufficiently? That is a good indicator.
It's one of the determinative.
Okay, again.
Three not voting in favour.
Ten.
So ten. And then the second question is whether if an entity uses the nature of expense method, the entity should provide additional information on the function of expenses if that information is used internally by management.
Again, subject to what level of management?
Yes, exactly.
CODM consistently used that as opposed to an infrequent analysis.
Yeah, I mean, we would probably look to lean on the sort of guidance that you've got in IFRS 8 in terms of defining the sorts of person you're talking about.
But if they look at it, if the CODM looks at it on a regular basis, then they'd be required by IFRS to disclose it in the segment note.
No.
That's different to...
Okay,
and I've seen what's
the staff recommendation.
3B is what we're voting for now.
1
in favour, I think.
So 3B, yes. Can I see who supports the staff recommendation? Nobody?
No. Fine.
Okay. No.
We're feeling good about ourselves.
Of course, that's right.
Sometimes we're not clear with what we think, so it should be, you know,
okay. So I've got a last issue here, and I would like to move on to issue 4, analyzing paragraphs 58 to 61. And the question that we are analyzing in this section is, should the board require the analysis of expenses in the statement of financial performance or in the notes? This question refers to both the primary and the secondary analysis, and we provide our recommendations there. So as the paper refers, IS-1 does not specifically require information by function or by nature to be in a particular location, i.e. we mean on the face or in the notes. So the staff proposal is that when an entity makes a choice of methodology, what we refer now as a primary analysis, this analysis should be presented on the face of the statement of financial performance. And the additional information supplementing this primary analysis, we suggest that, well, it could be presented together with the primary analysis on the face or in a single note. And so we ask the board below paragraph 61 if it agrees to, first of all, if it agrees to prescribe the location of the analysis of expenses. expenses required by IS1, and then secondly, if whether the board agrees with our proposals to present the primary and the secondary analysis.
Mary?
I think it's good to prescribe that you've got to do your selected presentation on the face of the statement of performance, so support that. Second, I think it's good to say that the supplemental analysis has to be in a single place, rather than you just have to provide the information somewhere in the financial statements. So I support the idea of in a single note. I'm really questioning the idea that it can be either on the face or in a single note. I go back to a comment of Gary's before about the statement of performance is supposed to be a summarized, summary of line items, and he was raising that as an objection to doing a columnar approach, and I'm really struggling to see how you can have the level of detail that I think I would expect integrated onto the face of the statement of financial performance. So I think you might end up with some pieces there and some pieces in a note elsewhere, so I think I would just go with the required primary presentation on the face of the statement of financial performance. And if you are presenting nature as a supplemental rather than the primary, that has to be in a single note.
Can I see people are nodding?
No, just yeah.
To this,
yeah, nodding.
To Mary's recommendation.
Nodding to Mary, yeah.
But for the clarification, just a simple rule.
Yeah.
The, just I'm wondering what is the, what the primary analysis of expense? Because the, you used the...
That's the choice that we made in question two.
Yeah, a question two, you used the analysis of expense. You put their primary in front of analysis. So that's the same thing as your manager said. Analysis of expense in question two is the same as the one. The primary analysis of expense here.
Yes.
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 That is a kind of a summary of the analysis of expense.
One you selected has to be on the face.
Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But we do not know the details of the scope of the analysis of the expenses. And how much we have the details of the...
No,
they're
going to be in a note.
Yeah. Just okay. I'm curious, before saying anything, yes or no.
Okay. Vote on Mary's articulation.
I have only one question to Zach, because if you... select by nature as a primary. Do you have then all the details in the primaries, in the primary financial statements, or do you still have the choice to? Do you have to do everything then in the? That is right.
You could have further disaggregation on
that. Yeah, that is man. How? But how?
How do you decide what?
How to decide?
Well,
what do
I think
do?
We're going to look at this.
Yeah, one of the final question which we've got in this paper is about additional things that we could look at as part of this project, which is looking at further guidance on sort of thresholds for amounts of disaggregation of items and prescribing additional minimum line items, which is something that we might look at a later stage, so bring back at a later board meeting. At the moment, it is just on the basic idea that you would present at an appropriate level of disaggregation your by nature presentation, if that is the one you choose. Yeah.
Okay, who can support Mary's recommendation, staff recommendation as modified by finally.
Yeah, finally, could we just get your reaction to the final part of this paper, where we are conscious that we need to issue more guidance to promote more disaggregation on the statement of financial performance. So we've got two ideas, and that's possibly increasing the number of minimum line items. At the moment, IS1 paragraph 82 has requires 13, and well, obviously. Specific standards also require other minimal line items that not necessarily included within paragraph 82. And then the other idea is to prescribe thresholds, come up with some thresholds to force the disaggregation of items such as other income, other expenses, or the other line items. similar to what regulators such as the SEC has done in their regulation 6. Thank you.
Something we've been moving towards, which was stopping having lists of items that needed to be disclosed. You know, a couple of years ago, we have standards modified so that, you know, we're getting away from a checklist approach. I felt that this was going back towards that, so I saw it as a backward step. I think that some of the things we're trying to do in issue 5 should be addressed as we start at back at issue 2, where we start saying, giving some guidance on how this election is going to happen and the way people will choose, and if they choose this, then they'll disclose something else, referring again to the tree diagram that we've mentioned.
I'm a bit torn because I completely agree with Anne that we're sort of trying to get away from this checklist approach, but on the other hand, if you look at the fact that in IAS1 we already talk about, you know, disclosing additional information that's relevant for users of the financial statements or whatever the words are, and how badly that's applied in practice, I feel like we need to do something more to encourage or at least signal the sort of information we think. I don't know whether that needs to be, you know, additional specific minimum line items, but I think it certainly needs to be some sort of pointer towards, you know, good principles of disaggregation.
Nick?
I wasn't going to mention amortization, but now Hans has reminded me, I can't resist the opportunity, I have to say. Just to flag, clearly within that amortization of intangibles number, there are items which are of a very different nature. So amortizing software, which is included in that number, which is more akin to depreciation, is very different from amortizing a customer list, which you've recognized through acquisition. And that causes problems for users trying to unpick that number. So it's the number one problem I have when I pick up a set of accounts. The first problem I face. On the questions we've been asked here, I'm reluctant to increase the number of minimum line items, but I would like to explore thresholds around other. An other number can be very frustrating when it's large and unspecified. Just you as a user have no way to get beneath that.
I suppose it's a bit hard to say, shall we look for additional line items without knowing what we'll see.
What industry you're talking
about? I mean, do we know from practice that some are really missing in missing in action?
I think when we talk to investors, they do have a concept that often come up.
Yeah, I think that's
where we know that just requiring them would solve a lot of problems in practice. If you have a feeling that those are there, then I don't even think you need an encouragement from us to go there. You should pick them up and bring them to the board. But just to ask you, please develop more line items. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
I think we've got a general idea that there are line items out there that people would like to see more of. I think what we need to do, what we're asking for, is do more research to actually identify what those line items might be, and we're asking, should we go away and do that research?
So
we don't want to do it if it's a non-starter for you guys. It is.
I think we can have no objections to.
Just to add something, it's just sometimes what happens is that the line items are required by other standards, but because they are not in the list in paragraph 82, then they are not included.
So they are just overlooked.
Overlooked, yes. So maybe it's
so
also the question.
Even while they are required.
Yeah, maybe the question is bringing all those line items required by other standards to that list.
Well, that's not adding line items. That's just clarifying the standards.
Well, yeah.
Bring it back. Do some. I don't know if we need a huge discussion about this. Barry, can you?
It's interesting for me to hear Denise say that there are requirements and standards that didn't get picked up in the list in IS1, and what I'm wondering in part is if they don't get picked up in one because we had determined that this information was
necessary for users, but not necessarily part of the structured summary that forms the state, you know, the statement of financial performance. So it could be that we were identifying an item that should be disclosed. So I'd say, staff, it would be really good to go through all the standards, identify things, and see if it's clear that they were intended to be required on the face, if material, or if it was just something that could be either in the face or in the notes. And if it's the latter, then I think I would hesitate to add it, you know, because we'll just create our own checklist in IS1, and that goes back to Anne's concern. I think we should only add a line item requirement to IS1, to the list in IS1, if we can define the item. And if we can't define the item, then adding it won't do much good, because we'll get false comparability by people presenting something with that label with having different underlying understandings of what it is. And that might be a really good test about whether it is another minimum line item. I tend to focus much more on B, developing thresholds. And I think about it more, not so much as developing thresholds, as developing guidance that might include thresholds about when you should disaggregate, but also what the limits are on aggregation. And that could come back to some of what Nick was talking about with other. You know, what are the limits on when you can throw things into one bucket that's called other? And does it have considerations of nature, magnitude, et cetera? So I think I would tend to say on this, focus more on B, but I think the exercise that Denise identified relating to requirements and standards that don't get captured by one might be a useful tool to think about.
Gary? Yeah. Quickly, sort of agree. I'm not looking for a prescriptive list of it, but if you wanted a suggestion, I would say for every revenue line that you've got, you should have a cost of revenue line. And you'll find that's in SX also. And so if you have three revenue lines, you'll have three cost of revenues lines, and maybe the total there, of course, profit. But typically the revenue lines are different because they have very different economic drivers or profitability or trends or so on. Then I'm on 62B, we're talking about Reg SX for P&L. By the way, for your POD project, they also have similar thresholds for other assets or liabilities as well.
Tom?
A couple of things. First of all, on thresholds, it's funny, there's two ways of looking at it. You could have a maximum threshold for an other that would trigger you disaggregating the other. You could also, if you had some individual items that were identified in the list or by a principal, that when they got big enough would trigger them appearing. And I was listening, I think Nick was in the former when he talked about thresholds.
I don't know if it's committed either way.
It sounded to me like when you described it, that's what I heard, which is what triggered me to make the note, because I actually hadn't stopped to think about which kind of threshold. So. One comment is you can have either kind of threshold. I have no idea the value of each, but they're different. Second one, Sue talked about a list of principles. I agree that a laundry list of items is not where IFRS is at. However, I think Sue's idea of some list of principles, possibly with examples, would still be good, because if we came up with a list of principles, I would be absolutely shocked that they would suggest that all the things that go into selling general and admin should always go in as a giant lump. And again, one of the major criticisms is that, you know, advertising, the human resources, the sales commissions, the legal people, the person who consults on pensions, that these are all ideally given out as a lump. What I think I come back to is, if this doesn't make sense, I've certainly heard from enough, you know, user types that this doesn't, is why do organizations not split it on their own when they're not forced to? And this is this question, I guess, of back to proprietary costs, which we haven't talked about today, but I think it's something we're going to run into. Organizations seem to be loath to do disaggregations that would make sense to me if I were going to try and analyze. And I don't quite know where we go on that. And one of the nice things about the laundry list versus the list of principles is if people really don't want to do it, they may try and skate away from, or maybe they can't skate away from the principles. Maybe we could have a good enough set of list of principles. But I am somewhat concerned that practice has been not to provide this finer set. And I think we would produce a better product if there was this more precise set of stuff out there. So I'm really sympathetic to the recommendation. Just how do we get there? And I think Sue's suggestion of principles might be a good way to start.
POD projector.
I think we need some more information about what are the biggest missing links according to the market and what Daisy Ray said, Denise said should be explored further, which is that line items that are prescribed are simply not being followed.
Also, I think in addition to the other example which Nick gave, which I'd agree with, the one that Tom mentioned that comes up a lot in meetings like CMAC is things like cost of goods sold, how many different things get lumped in that and how different it is between entities. Some of these big buckets of...
Well, you'd be amazed.
Pulling some of that apart, I think.
If I give you a simple example, selling expense, is that cost of goods sold? You don't sell without sales commissions, or is that SG&A? You know, I guarantee you there's no uniformity of practice on that.
Thank you. I agree with what Nick and Mary said. So to go to A, it's a bit dangerous to have lots of minimum line items, which could be a checklist style. But in terms of B, we need some threshold, especially when we have a huge number of other, that makes the analyst job difficult. And having said that, we already... Our IS1 already requires to have line items if it's necessary. So it's a matter of compliance. So therefore, it's up to the regulator or auditors to require more disaggregation for those line items of other. Having said that again, not working very well, especially if you look at the case in Japan. So it's voluntary application of IFRS. And the Japanese GAAP used to have a very precise line item, but the IFRS is quite rough. So they think it's
principles
easy.
Based.
Yeah, make it big number of others. And actually, we have a regulator, but do not apply such a precise chart of account to the IFRS. So that gave an impression that the IFRS is much, rougher than the Japanese GAAP, which has less quality. Somebody argues in that way. So that is the matter of compliance. But not always we have a good regulator like SEC. So we may have the situation, some developing country or some other cases.
A good regulator, this is very hard to enforce.
Yeah.
We have other things to do.
Yeah. Other
there
things.
Are no clear requirements, what is necessary.
Yes. So therefore, we need to explore some extent, so others shouldn't be this much. Or, as I said, if you have pop up this big number of items, which should be identified. So we need to explore. So to answer the question, we need to explore.
Mary, final shot.
Just quickly thinking about what Tuck said, maybe we encourage the staff to go back and frame this in terms of taking that general statement in IS1 about providing additional line items that are relevant and that being a requirement, that our experience has told us that we need to provide more guidance about when something would be considered relevant and in terms of breaking that out so link it back to that existing requirement.
I don't think we're going to vote on this. No. Staff knows what to do. We take a break. I think the staff for papers are good.